Bridget says sympathetically, coming back to the table with two cups of coffee. She puts out milk and sugar and sits down across from Karen.
I've seen the detectives going in and out of your place. They were here, too, asking questions.
They came here, Karen says, feigning surprise. Why would they come here? What did they ask you?
They wanted to know if I'd seen you leaving that night, before your accident. Whether there was someone with you, that kind of thing.
Oh. Karen nods. That made sense. They know that she left the house alone, in a hurry, after getting that call at 8:17 p.m. Karen wishes she knew exactly what else the detectives know, or suspect.
I told them I didn't see anything. I wasn't home.
Karen takes a sip of her coffee. Thanks for the brownies, by the way, she says. They were delicious, as always.
Oh, you're welcome. I couldn't eat them all myself, anyway.
You must have dropped them off when the police were over, Karen says. Bridget nods.
I didn't want to bother you, she says, so I thought it would be better just to drop them off.
For the first time, it occurs to Karen to wonder why Bridget didn't leave them on the porch, which is the custom around here. That's what neighbors do if someone's sick or has a baby or there's been a death in the family. They leave a plate of something outside the front door, never the back.
Why didn't you just leave them on the porch?
Bridget hesitates.
I didn't want to interrupt. I thought if I went to the front, you might hear me and come to the door.
You must have overheard some things when you were in the kitchen, Karen suggests.
No, I didn't hear anything, Bridget says. I just dropped them and left.
She leans toward Karen, concern on her face.
But I know detectives don't usually investigate car accidents. What's really going on, Karen?
Karen looks back at her and makes a quick calculation. She has to tell Bridget something. They're investigating a murder.
A murder?
Bridget looks aghast.
What's that got to do with you?
I don't know. Karen shakes her head. Some man was shot. All they know is that my car was in the area, and because I was driving so fast and had my accident, they think I might know something about what happened. Like, probably I was a witness or something. So they keep coming around, prodding me to see if they can get me to remember something. They want me to help nail whoever it was that killed that man. But unfortunately, I haven't been much help. How fluidly the lies come, she thinks.
Do the doctors have any idea how long it will take for you to remember?
Karen shakes her head again. I may never remember because of the trauma of it. They think maybe I saw something terrible happen.
Well, you've got other things to do than do the cops' jobs for them. Let them figure it out, Bridget says.
She gets up and grabs a box of cookies from the cupboard and brings them back to the table.
Want one?
Karen takes a cookie out of the package. Bridget takes one too, has a sip of coffee, and says,
So you still have no idea why you left the house so quickly?
Karen hesitates and says, Apparently, I got a phone call, but I don't remember who from.
And the police can't figure it out?
Bridget asks over her coffee cup, her eyes wide. Karen is now sorry she's told Bridget anything. She doesn't want to tell her about the burner phone. How's she going to explain why the police can't figure out who called her? No, they can't, Karen says rather abruptly, wanting to be done with the conversation. She swallows the last of her cookie and gets up to go. I really should be going. I was on my way out for a walk. The two of them get up from the table. As they go out through the living room, Bridget asks,
Do you think you're in any danger?
Karen turns back abruptly and looks at her.
Why do you say that?
Perhaps Bridget can see the fear in Karen's eyes.
Just, you know, if the police think you're a witness and that you know something, maybe someone else might think so, too.
Karen stares at her, saying nothing.
I'm sorry. I don't want to make you worry, Brigid says. I shouldn't have said anything.
No, it's okay. I've thought that myself, Karen lies.
Brigid nods. They're both standing outside on the front porch now. But Tom's not going to let anything happen to you. Chapter 25.
Tom's agreed to meet his brother Dan at their favorite Greasy Spoon for lunch. Dan also works downtown. Their offices aren't far apart. When Dan called earlier this morning, he sounded worried. Tom's been keeping him pretty much in the dark. Suddenly, Tom felt guilty for not staying in better touch. He also feels the need to talk to someone he can trust. And right now, it feels like his little brother is the only person who fits that description. When Tom gets to the restaurant, he finds a table in the back corner and waits for his brother. When Dan arrives, Tom waves him over.
Hey, Dan says, you don't look so great.
There's concern in his eyes.
Yeah, well, Tom says, looking up at his brother. Have a seat.
What's going on? Dan asks, sitting down. I haven't heard from you in the last couple of days. How's Karen?
Tom says,
she's doing okay.
But his distress must be coming across loud and clear. Dan could always read him pretty well.
So what are you not telling me, Tom?
Dan says, leaning toward him.
What the fuck is going on?
Tom takes a deep breath and leans in closer, pausing while the waiter drops a couple of menus on their table and moves out of earshot. Then he tells Dan everything. About the dead man, the gloves, the call from the burner phone. Dan looks back at him in disbelief.
This doesn't make any sense. What would Karen be doing there? And who the hell would be calling Karen on a burner phone?
We don't know, Tom says, but it made the police suspicious.
No kidding, Dan says. So, what do you think Karen was up to that night?
Dan looks worried.
I don't know, Tom says, and shifts his eyes away. She still says she doesn't remember.
Tom wonders if Dan can sense his own doubt. There's a long silence between them, and then Tom says,
maybe we should order.
Sure.
As they review the menu, Tom tries to decide whether to tell Dan the rest. That he's starting to wonder about Karen's past. That she might be hiding something from him. What if he's wrong? But first, there's something else he needs to talk to Dan about. The waiter takes their order, and Tom sets the menu aside.
The police are asking questions about me.
About you? What the hell are you talking about? Dan asks.
He looks genuinely freaked out now, as if he's afraid of what he's going to hear next. Tom leans in closer to his brother and lowers his voice further.
They're asking where I was at the time of Karen's accident. At the time of the murder.
There's a long, pregnant pause while Dan stares at him.
Why the hell would they be asking you that? Dan says.
Tom swallows.
I never told you this, but... You know that neighbor of ours, Brigid, who lives across the street? I think you've met her.
Yeah, sure. What about her?
Tom looks down at the table, ashamed of what he's about to admit.
I was involved with her before I met Karen.
Dan says, rather sharply, isn't she married?
Yes, but...
He meets Dan's eyes briefly, then shifts his gaze away.
She misled me. She said her marriage was already over, that they were separating. But she was lying.
Brigid had tricked him into an affair. He'd only realized it when Bob invited himself over for a beer one evening, obviously unaware of what was going on between Tom and his wife, and it became clear that Bob had no idea that his marriage was in trouble. That she'd lied. Tom had been easy enough to manipulate. He'd felt an overwhelming attraction to her. There was something terribly exciting about Brigid, about her disregard for boundaries. She was his walk on the wild side. But as soon as Tom realized that she'd lied to him about the state of her marriage, he broke it off. As he expected, she didn't take it well. She coaxed, she sobbed, she screamed. He was afraid she might do something rash. Tell her husband about them, slash his tires. But then she'd calmed down and agreed not to tell Bob. Shortly after that, Tom met Karen. When he became serious about her, he made Bridget promise not to tell Karen about what had happened between them. He was ashamed of sleeping with another man's wife, even though it was only because he'd been deceived. He didn't know then that Bridget and Karen would become close friends. He'd watched it happen with deep dismay. He'd had a few uncomfortable moments. He didn't completely trust Bridget not to say something, but Bridget had kept her side of the bargain. For a long time, his only relationship with Bridget had been as a friend of Karen's. Until she called that day.
"So," Dan says slowly, "what are you trying to tell me, Tom? Are you sleeping with her again? Were you with her that night?"
Their food arrives and they abruptly stop talking until they're alone again. Tom's feeling very uncomfortable with this conversation. He looks earnestly at his brother and says firmly,
"No, I'm not sleeping with her. Like I said, it was over before I even met Karen. And Karen doesn't know about it. She thinks we're just neighbors. We agreed to keep it quiet." "Was that wise?" Dan asks. "In hindsight, no."
"So why can't you tell the police where you were, Tom?"
"Christ, please don't tell me you're mixed up in anything."
Dan looks distraught. Tom interrupts him. "I haven't done anything wrong. I'm not involved in this thing that Karen's tangled up in. Whatever the hell it is, I promise you that." He hesitates.
"But Bridget called me that day, the day of the accident, and asked me to meet her that evening. She wanted to talk to me about something. She said it was important."
He runs his hands through his hair.
"But she never showed up. I waited for over half an hour, and now the police want to know where I was. I told them I was just driving around for a while, trying to unwind because work is so stressful. I lied in front of Karen."
"What a mess," Dan says. Tom nods.
"Yes, it is, isn't it? You have to tell the police the truth, and Karen is going to find out."
Tom frowns unhappily.
"I know. So what did Bridget want to talk to you about?"
Tom looks up uneasily at his brother and tells him about the dark-haired man snooping around the house that day and Bridget's suspicions about Karen's past.
"She says she saw some TV show, and what that man said made her think that maybe Karen disappeared from another life and that she's using an alias," Tom says.
"Seriously?" Tom nods.
"I know. It sounds ridiculous, right? But she told me she wanted to meet me that night and tell me in person because she thought if she tried to tell me over the phone, I'd just hang up on her."
"Why would you?"
Tom looks away.
"She used to call me, and I'd hang up on her. But that was a long time ago."
"So why didn't she show up then?"
Tom looks Dan in the eye again.
"She said her sister needed her. Her sister's always having a crisis. Anyway, she's got this idea in her head now about how little we know about Karen's past, how she has no relatives and so on."
"She's right about that,"
Dan says slowly.
"And I started to think about it.
My God, Dan, what if Bridget's right?" Chapter 26. Tom returns to his office after lunch, but he's not back long when the receptionist out front buzzes him and tells him that two gentlemen are here to see him. The two gentlemen can only be those damned detectives. He saw them just last night. Why do they want to talk to him again today? Tom feels sweat start to form down the middle of his back beneath his shirt. He takes a moment to compose himself, straightening his tie a little, and then says,
"Send them in."
Tom comes out from behind his desk as Detectives Rasbach and Jennings enter his office.
"Good afternoon," Tom says, closing the door behind them.
He remembers how Dan urged him to cooperate with the police. He must tell them about Brigid.
"Good afternoon," Rasbach says pleasantly.
Tom dislikes Rasbach's pleasantness. From his experience, it's always hiding something disturbing. Tom returns to his desk and wonders anxiously if they have a bombshell to drop. First it was the gloves at the murder scene, then the call from the burner phone. What will it be this time?
"We have a few more questions," Rasbach begins as they are all seated.
"I'm sure you do," Tom says.
The detective regards him impassively.
"Where did you meet your wife?" Rasbach asks.
"What difference does it make?" Tom says, surprised.
"Bear with me," Rasbach says mildly, "and answer the question."
"She was a temp here at the office. She was only here for a couple of weeks. She's a bookkeeper, but she was new in town, so she was doing a bit of temping. She wanted to be placed in an accounting firm. She worked on our floor for 2 weeks. When her assignment was over, I asked her out."
Rasbach nods and tilts his head to the side.
"Do you know much about your wife? I'm married to her. What do you think?" Tom says testily.
His mind is racing. What have they found out? His heart begins to pound. That's why they're here. To tell him who his wife really is. Rasbach waits a moment, then leans slightly forward and assumes a more sympathetic expression.
"I don't mean, do you know what her favorite toothpaste is? I mean, do you know where she came from? Her past?"
"Of course."
"Which is what?" Rasbach asks.
Even though he suspects he's walking right into a trap, Tom can't think of anything else to say, so he tells them what Karen has told him.
"She was born and raised in Wisconsin. Her parents are dead. She has no brothers or sisters." "Anything else?"
"Yes, lots of things."
Now Tom glares at the detective and says, because he can't bear the tension any longer,
"Why don't you get to the point?"
"All right," Rasbach says. "Your wife is not who she says she is."
Tom looks back at him, deliberately impassive.
"You don't seem surprised," Rasbach says.
"Nothing you people say surprises me anymore," Tom replies.
"Really?"
Rasbach says.
"It doesn't surprise you to learn that you're married to a woman who disappeared and took on a new identity?"
The detective leans forward and fixes his eyes on Tom's, and Tom finds that he cannot look away.
"Your wife was not born Karen Fairfield."
Tom sits perfectly still. He doesn't know what to do. Should he admit his suspicions about Karen? Or pretend he has no idea? Into the silence, Rasbach presses.
"Your wife has been lying to you about who she is."
"No, she hasn't," Tom says stubbornly.
"I'm afraid so," Rasbach says. "She invented Karen Fairfield and a background for her. It was well done, considering, but not good enough to bear real scrutiny. She would have been fine if she'd kept her nose clean. If she'd stayed out of trouble, no one would probably ever have been the wiser. But showing up at a murder scene was not a smart move."
"I don't believe it," Tom protests.
He tries to look indignant, but he knows he probably just looks like a desperate man in denial of an ugly truth.
"Come now," Rasbach says. "You don't trust your wife much more than I do."
"What?" Tom snaps. "What are you talking about? Of course I trust my wife."
Tom feels himself flush up to the roots of his hair.
"If you're so goddamned smart," Tom says, before he can stop himself, "who is she then?"
He immediately regrets asking, dreading the answer. Rasbach sits back in his chair and says,
"We don't know yet, but we'll find out.
Well, when you find out, I'm sure you'll let me know, Tom says bitterly.
Of course we will, Razbok assures him.
He gets up to leave and adds, By the way, have you had a chance to think any more about where you were that night? The son of a bitch.
Tom steels himself. He knows this is going to be painful.
I didn't tell you everything last night, he says.
Razbok, standing, looks back at him, waiting.
I didn't want to tell you because you'll twist it into something it isn't.
Razbok sits down again.
We deal in facts, Mr. Krupp. Why don't you give us a chance?
Tom glares at him.
I was supposed to meet someone. Bridget Cruikshank, a neighbor from across the street.
Razbok looks at him, waiting for more.
She called me and wanted to meet at 8:30, down by the river. I went there, but she didn't show up.
Razbok retrieves his notebook from his suit pocket.
Why not? She says her sister needed her. Why did she want to meet you? I don't know.
Tom lies. He doesn't want to tell the detective about the dark-haired man Bridget saw around their house that morning. Bridget said she hadn't told the detectives about him.
You haven't asked her?
Tom knows he has to tell them.
If you must know, before I met my wife, Bridget and I had a... Well, we had an affair.
Razbok looks back at him steadily.
Go on, he says. It was very brief. I broke it off just before I met Karen. And does your wife know?
No, I never told her.
Why's that? Why the hell do you think? And you have no idea why this Bridget wanted to meet you that night.
Tom shakes his head.
No. Karen's accident put it right out of my mind somehow. You're not sleeping with her now?
No, absolutely not.
I see.
Tom wants more than anything to take a swing at the detective. But he doesn't. As they take their leave, Tom stands up and watches them go. He has to stop himself from slamming the door behind them in fury. Chapter 27.
Do you think he knows who his wife really is?
Jennings asks as they settle into the car and buckle up.
Razbok shakes his head.
I doubt it. He looked terrified that we were going to tell him something about his wife he didn't want to hear.
He pauses and adds,
He's got to be going through hell.
Jennings nods.
Can you imagine going to bed every night with a woman who might be a murderer? It's got to take a toll.
Razbok is frustrated that they haven't been able to find any missing persons who match Karen's profile.
Who the hell is she? He wonders out loud. I'd like to bring her in for questioning, but I don't want to spook her.
He considers for a moment.
If we had enough to arrest her, we could get her prints and see if we could get an ID that way. We know she's involved somehow, but the evidence we have against her now isn't enough. Trying to find out who she is like looking for a needle in a haystack, Jennings says. You know how many people disappear in this country every year?
Razbok raises his eyebrows at him.
I was speaking rhetorically, of course, Jennings adds.
I think the key to this is the victim, Razbok says. Unidentified woman possibly kills unidentified man. Who are these people?
Organized crime? Witness protection?
Could be. I don't know.
But if we can ID either one of them, I think we'll be able to ID the other.
He's quiet for a moment.
She knows, Razbok says thoughtfully. As they pull into the station, he adds,
Let's ask her to come in. We'll be low-key about it.
Karen gets into the shower, allowing herself to cry while the water pours over her. She doesn't want to flee. She doesn't want to leave Tom. But that might be her only option if things go south really quickly. After a while, she pulls herself together because she has to. She can't just go to pieces. Even if it looks really bad right now, it doesn't necessarily mean the police are going to be able to build a case. She needs to talk to Jack Calvin again. Without her husband, she needs to know what her options are. Because as soon as they identify the victim, as soon as they realize the dead man is Robert Traynor, then they will look more deeply into his life. They will see that his wife died rather tragically almost 3 years ago. There are photos of Georgina Traynor. She knows that detective will recognize her. He's going to put it together and realize that she'd faked her suicide to run away from her husband, that he found her, and that he called her on the burner phone that night. And he's going to think she killed him. She feels sick with fear. It's just a matter of time. And Tom, what will Tom think when he finds out that she's a fraud? That when he wed her, she was already legally married to someone else? What is he going to think when they try to tell him that she's a murderer? She gets dressed quickly and retrieves Jack Calvin's card from her wallet. She looks at the emergency number on the back. He said she could call him at this number at any time. She sits down on the living room sofa and reaches for the phone, but before she can lift the receiver, it rings. Startled, she answers it. Yes?
It's Detective Rasbach.
They know. Yes, Detective, she manages to say, her chest tight.
We'd like you to come down to the station and answer some questions. Completely voluntarily, of course. You're not obligated to do so.
For a moment, she freezes. What should she do? Why?
She asks. We have a few more questions, he repeats.
Have you identified the man who died? She asks.
Not yet, the detective says.
Her pulse races. She doesn't believe him. Fine. When would you like me to come? She tries to keep her voice casual, so he won't know how terribly frightened she is.
Any time this afternoon would be fine. Do you know where the police station is?
He tells her where to find him, but she's not listening. After she hangs up, she walks briskly to the bedroom and hurriedly starts packing a bag. Chapter 28. Tom grabs his cell phone off his desk and prepares to leave, although it's only early afternoon. He gives the receptionist a terse, "I won't be back for the rest of the day," without looking at her, and makes his way out of the building to the parking lot. He drives down to the river and simply stares at the water flowing by for a while. It does nothing to soothe him. He doesn't know who his wife is. Where did the lies begin? And when will they stop? He feels tears burning his eyes and rubs them away. Suddenly, he needs to confront her. He can't stand the tension between them anymore, the stress of being under the scrutiny of the police, the needling from that horrible detective. Tom gets back into his car and drives home, nursing his anger, so that he has the courage to confront her. When he pulls into the driveway, he feels a little tug of fear at his heart. What will he find waiting for him this time? She won't be expecting him now. It's early afternoon. He lets himself in the house quietly. He wants to surprise her, see what she's doing when she doesn't know he's home. He walks softly around the first floor. She's not there. Then he walks up the carpeted stairs and down the hall to the bedroom. He stands at the open bedroom door, his heart breaking at what he sees. Her back is turned to him, and she's absorbed in the task of packing an overnight bag. Her movements are hurried. She's running away. Was she even going to tell him? He opens his mouth to say her name, but no words come out. He stands there, stricken, watching the woman he loves preparing to leave him without even saying goodbye. She turns suddenly and sees him, She gives a little jump of surprise and fear. And then they stare at each other for a long moment, saying nothing. "Tom," she says, and then falls silent. He sees the tears start in her eyes and spill down her face. She doesn't move to embrace him. He doesn't move toward her, either.
"Where are you going?" he asks brusquely, although he realizes it doesn't matter. She's leaving, and it doesn't matter where she goes. She's leaving him to avoid a murder charge.
At this moment, he doesn't even know for sure if he wants to stop her. "Detective Rasbach called a few minutes ago," she says, her voice shaky. "He wants me to go down to the police station for questioning." Tom stares at her, waiting for more.
"Tell me," he thinks. "Tell me the fucking truth."
"I don't want to go," she says, and looks away and down. "I don't want to leave you." Tears are streaming down her face now.
"Did you kill that man?" Tom asks in a low, desperate voice. "Tell me."
She looks back at him with dread. "It's not how it looks," she says.
"Then tell me how it is,"
Tom says harshly, glancing for a moment at the overnight bag resting on the bed, contents half spilling out, and then fixing his eyes on hers.
"I want to know what happened. I want to hear it from you, and I want it to be the truth."
He wants her to exonerate herself in his eyes. That's all he wants. And then he can take her in his arms and figure out what to do. He wants to stand by her if he can. He loves her. That hasn't changed. He's surprised that he can still love her when he doesn't trust her. He wants to trust her again. He wants her to be honest with him. "It's too late," Karen says, collapsing to the bed and covering her face with her hands. "They know. They must know."
"Know what? What do they know? Tell me," Tom cries.
"He was my husband," she says, looking dully up at him.
"Who?"
Tom says, not understanding at first. "The dead man. He was my husband."
"No," Tom thinks. "No, this can't be happening."
She looks up at him, her eyes filled with tears. "I ran away from him. I was afraid of him," she says. "He was abusive. He said if I left him, if I ever tried to leave him, he would kill me." As Tom listens, he grows numb with horror. His fear is huge, but his heart also fills with a fierce desire to comfort and protect her. "His name was Robert Traynor," she tells him in a monotone. "We were married 6 years ago and lived in Las Vegas."
Las Vegas? He can't imagine Karen in Las Vegas.
"As soon as we were married, he changed. It was like he became someone else." She looks down at the floor, shoulders slumping. Tom remains standing, looking down at her. After a pause, she continues. "I realized that I would never be able to get away from him. I couldn't leave him or divorce him. I knew a restraining order wouldn't help. I knew if I ran away, he would follow me to the ends of the earth." She says this bitterly, her voice ragged. She looks up at him, eyes filled with remorse. "I'm so sorry," she whispers. "I never meant to hurt you. I love you, Tom. I didn't want any of this to touch you." The tears flow down her face. Her hair is tangled. "After I got away from him, I just wanted to pretend that part of my life had never happened." She turns away hopelessly. "I wanted to erase the past." Then she seems to stall. Tom looks at her, his heart breaking, but he's also wary. He knows there's more coming. She gathers her resolve and starts again.
I faked my death. It was the only way to be sure he wouldn't come after me.
Tom stands utterly still and listens to her with growing despair. She tells him everything. How she got a new identity and faked her jump off the Hoover Dam Bridge. He's certain now that she's telling him the truth, but more appalled than ever at where this is leading.
Then, a few weeks ago, I began to notice things. Things that scared me.
What kind of things? She raises her head and looks at him.
Someone had been in the house. Remember when I called you at work that day and asked if you would come home in the middle of the day? I told you I must have left a window open. But that wasn't true. Someone had been through my things. Someone had gone through my drawers. I could tell. You know how tidy I am. I knew things had been moved. I was terrified. I thought it was him.
She looks at him with an expression of abject misery.
I think he was coming into our house for weeks, sneaking in when we weren't home.
She shudders.
Once I could tell that someone had lain down on our bed. I started taking pictures on my phone in the morning before I left for work. I could tell that things had been moved sometimes. I didn't know what to do. I couldn't tell you.
She looks at him beseechingly.
Why couldn't you tell me, Karen? Tom asks desperately. I would have understood. I would have helped you. We could have figured out what to do together.
Did she trust him so little? He would have stood by her if only she'd been honest with him.
We could have gone to the police. I wouldn't have let him hurt you.
He thinks, and then you wouldn't be a murderer, and our lives wouldn't be destroyed.
I've started to remember, she confesses. Last night, not when we were down there, where it happened, but later when the phone rang, it started to come back.
She wipes her eyes with the back of her hand.
He called me that night.
Her face takes on an additional pallor as she tells him the rest.
He said, "Hi, Georgina." And his voice was exactly the same. Coaxing and threatening at the same time. It was as if I were right back there, with him.
Tom notices that her eyes have become glazed, and her voice has gone flat.
I wanted to hang up, but I had to know what he was going to do. I knew he'd found me. That he'd been in our house. I was so scared.
She starts to shake. Tom sits down on the bed beside her and puts his arm around her shoulders. He can feel her body tremble. His own heart is beating wildly. He has to hear the rest of her story. All of it. He has to know where they stand before he can figure out what to do.
He said, "Didn't I think I was clever, fooling everybody? But I didn't fool him," he said. He kept on looking for me. I don't know how he found me. He said that if he couldn't have me, then nobody could. He told me to meet him at that restaurant.
She looks at Tom with terrible fear in her eyes.
He said if I didn't come, he would kill you, Tom. He knew all about you. He knew where we lived.
He believes her now. Every word. He folds her into his arms and lets her cry. Her sobs beat against his chest. He kisses the top of her head and thinks furiously about what they should do. Finally, she pulls away from him and tells him the rest, staring at the floor.
I took my gun. I've kept a gun hidden in case he ever found me. And I drove there to meet him. I parked in that lot, and I went to the back door of the restaurant.
She looks up at him urgently.
I swear, Tom, I didn't plan to kill him. I took the gun for my own protection. I was going to tell him I would go to the police and tell them everything, that I wasn't afraid of him anymore. I wasn't thinking clearly. I should have gone to the police first. I know that now. When I got there, the back door was open. I remember putting my hand on it, but that's all I remember. After that, everything is still just a blank.
She looks up at him.
I don't know what happened after that, Tom. I swear.
He looks down at her traumatized face. Does she really not remember? She collapses, exhausted, into his arms. He holds her while she cries. So now he knows. She had good reason for what she did. He can't condemn her for it. Perhaps she really doesn't remember. Perhaps it's too difficult for her to face. She took the gun. He understands that. But she also took the gloves. It looks like she meant to do it. What the hell do they do now? She sits up straight again. Her face is blotchy from crying, her eyes swollen.
I must have panicked. And I drove too fast and ran those red lights and went into that pole.
What happened to the gun? Tom asks, thinking rapidly.
I don't know. I must have left it there. It obviously wasn't in the car. I suppose someone found it and took it.
Tom's heart beats fast in fear at what she's done, at the terrible uncertainty of their position. What if someone turns in the gun? What then?
Jesus, Tom says. I'm sorry, she says miserably. I didn't want to tell you. I didn't want to lose you, and I don't want to get you into trouble, too. This is my problem. I have to fix it. I can't let it touch you.
It has touched me, Karen. He takes her by the arms and looks deeply into her tear-filled eyes and speaks urgently. It's your lawyer's job to fix it. It's going to be okay. You were afraid for your life. You had good reason for what you did.
What are you saying? She asks, drawing back. I still don't think I killed him, Tom. I don't think I could do that.
He looks at her in disbelief.
Then who did? I don't know.
She looks at him as if hurt that he doubts her.
I wasn't the only one who hated him.
He hugs her close to him so he doesn't have to look in her eyes, and whispers,
Don't run. Stay and face this. Don't leave me.
Chapter 29. An hour later, Karen and Tom present themselves once again at Jack Calvin's office. Karen has washed her face and reapplied her makeup. She now feels calm and detached, almost stoic in the face of disaster. She takes comfort in Tom's support, but she's terrified of what happens next.
Come in, Calvin says, brisk and professional. He'd rearranged his calendar for this meeting. There's no chit-chat today. Have a seat.
As they sit, Karen thinks of how every time she's in this office, things are worse.
What's happened? Calvin asks, studying each of them intently.
She lifts her eyes to his and says, Detective Rasbach has asked me to come down to the station this afternoon to answer some questions. I'd like you to be there with me.
Calvin looks carefully from her to Tom and back to her again. He says, Why go at all? You're not obligated to. You're not under arrest.
Maybe I will be soon, Karen says. Jack Calvin doesn't look as surprised as he might have, she thinks.
He picks up a yellow legal pad and that same expensive pen she recognizes from her last visit, and waits.
"Maybe I'd better start at the beginning," she says, and takes a deep breath and exhales. "I staged my suicide and ran away to escape an abusive husband. I've been living under a new identity."
"Okay," Calvin says slowly.
"Is that a crime?"
"That depends. It's not a crime, per se, to fake your death, but you may have committed other crimes in doing so. And adopting a false identity is perpetrating a fraud. But let's come back to that later. What was your name before?"
"Georgina Traynor. I was married to Robert Traynor. He's the man they're trying to identify, the one who was killed that night."
She glances at Tom for support, but he's watching the lawyer, not looking at her. Now Calvin seems worried. She knows how bad it looks. Tom says, clearly agitated,
"As soon as they identify him, they're going to figure it out. They'll see that his wife died. They already know that Karen took on a new identity, that Karen Fairfield isn't who she really is. They've already been to my office to tell me."
Karen looks at him in shock. "Tom already knew. The detectives know."
"You didn't tell me that," she says.
But he turns away from her and looks at Calvin.
"What matters is what they can prove," Calvin says evenly.
He leans forward over his desk.
"So, tell me what happened that night," he says. "And please remember, I have a duty not to lie to the court, so don't tell me anything that will put me in a difficult position."
She hesitates. "I don't remember everything yet, but I can tell you what I do remember," she says. She tells Calvin what she told Tom earlier, except she leaves out any mention of the gun. But she tells him everything else, up to when she opened the door of the restaurant. Calvin stares at her as if trying to decide whether to believe her. An ominous silence fills the office.
"Might you have had a gun with you, hypothetically?"
"There may have been a gun, hypothetically," she answers carefully.
"Is there any way that this hypothetical gun, should it be found, could be traced back to you?"
He looks at her closely, concerned. The gun was purchased illegally and not registered to her. They can't trace it to her if it's found. And there are no fingerprints on it, she's sure of that. She never handled it without gloves.
"No," she says firmly.
Calvin sits back in his chair, which squawks a little, and is quiet, obviously thinking. Then he leans forward again and places both hands on his desk.
"Here's what we are going to do," Calvin says. "We are going to see if they come up with enough to charge you. I'm sure they will once they identify him. The circumstantial evidence is strong. It will be enough, but it's another matter to prove it at trial."
"But," Karen blurts out.
Calvin looks at her inquiringly.
"But what?"
"I couldn't have killed him," she says firmly.
"I couldn't have," she repeats. "I don't think I'm capable of it." Her lawyer and her husband look at her. Tom quickly glances away, almost as if he's embarrassed. But the lawyer stares at her. Calvin says,
"Who do you think might have killed him?"
"I don't know."
"Can you take a guess?"
She glances at Tom and then looks back at the lawyer again.
"He might have had enemies."
"What kind of enemies?"
"Business enemies."
"What kind of business was he in?"
the lawyer asks.
"He was an antiques dealer." She adds, "I'm not sure all of his business dealings were entirely on the up and up, but I knew better than to ask. He knew some shady people."
There's a silence in the room that seems to stretch on forever. Karen sits completely still in her chair. The thought of going to trial for murder terrifies her.
Sitting in the lawyer's office, she realizes it's too late. I should have run, she thinks. Finally, she says, Detective Rasbach is expecting me at the station.
You're not going, Calvin says. When they think they've got enough, then let them arrest you. Now, tell me more about how you got away from Robert Traynor.
She tells him everything. About the months of planning. How she squirreled money away. All the while secretly visiting a women's shelter for support. And finally what she did that day at the Hoover Dam bypass bridge. She adds in a dull voice, In a way, it was easy, because I had no family to leave behind. My parents were dead, I had no siblings. We had no life insurance policy on me, so I knew the insurance companies wouldn't be looking into it. I thought I could pull it off, and I was desperate. I didn't think I had anything to lose. When she's finished, there's a long silence. Then Calvin asks, What did you do with the pack? Oh, yes, that. She pauses, remembering. I had to get rid of it, but I couldn't just toss it out the window. Everything in it could be traced back to me, so I added some heavy rocks to it and dropped it off a bridge into a lake in the middle of the night. Tom looks at her as she says this, and then averts his eyes, as if he can't bear to imagine her doing it. I know it makes me seem cold-blooded, Karen says. Eyeing each of them almost defiantly. But what would you have done in my place? When neither man answers, she says, Right. You would never be in my place. How wonderful for you. How easy it must be to be a man. Tom shoots her a conciliatory look, as if he personally wants to make up for every lousy male on the planet. She says to him, I kept thinking I would tell you at some point. She asks him now, ignoring the lawyer as if he weren't even in the room. When should I have told you? Right at the beginning? What would you want with a woman who'd run away from her life and had a fake ID? Later on? You would have felt hurt, lied to, like you do now. The truth is, there was never a good time to tell you. She's almost matter of fact. She isn't exactly apologizing. She did what she had to do. And this is the result. Tom squeezes her hand, but he isn't looking at her. He's looking down at her hand in his. Chapter 30. As they leave Calvin's office, the lawyer tells them, It probably won't be long before they identify the victim, and then things are going to get tense. You've got to be prepared for that. He looks them both in the eye. His gaze lingers longer on Tom, as if he can sense that of the two, Tom is the least prepared for what's going to happen. Tom suspects he's right. His wife is much stronger than he ever realized. He can't imagine cold-bloodedly faking his own death to escape a maniac and starting over as someone else. She must have nerves of steel, he thinks. He's not sure he likes thinking of her that way. As they make their way back to the car in the parking lot, Tom is utterly terrified. Their lives are going to enter a whole new realm of awful. She will probably be charged with murder. She will have to go to trial. She may even be convicted. He doesn't know if he's strong enough for this, if their love for each other can survive what's ahead. Tom drives, focusing on the road in front of him, mostly because he doesn't want to look at his wife. But he can feel her eyes on him. I'm so sorry, Tom, she says. I didn't want to do this to you. He doesn't trust his voice to answer. He swallows and keeps his eyes straight ahead. I never should have agreed to marry you without telling you everything, she whispers, distraught. It dawns on him then. They're not really married. On the day of their wedding, she was already legally married to someone else. The thought makes his head spin. She stood beside him when they were saying their vows, and she knew she was already married to somebody else. Her vows were meaningless. He has to resist the urge to stop the car suddenly and tell her to get out. Somehow, he keeps driving.
"It's okay,"
he says.
"It's going to be okay."
He's saying it automatically. He doesn't believe it. Maybe if he could just hold her, without looking into her eyes, he would be all right. He needs a moment to ground himself again so that he can go on, but he's driving the car. They ride in silence. As they reach home, he tells her,
"I have to go back to the office for a bit. Not for long. I'll be home soon, for supper."
She nods. "Okay." He stops in their driveway, and before she gets out of the car, he leans over and hugs her tight. For that moment, he tries to forget everything that's happened, and to focus on how it feels to have her in his arms. Then he pulls away from her and says,
"Don't run. Promise me."
"I promise." He holds her eyes with his. Even now, he doesn't know if he believes her. Is this what life is always going to be like now? Tom lets her go and then reverses the car and heads back downtown. He has no intention of returning to work. He heads back to his spot by the river, wishing he could wash himself clean of the whole sordid business, but knowing that he cannot. Not now. Not ever. Bridget had been making a little baby sweater in pale yellow for a friend who was expecting, but found she couldn't bear it, so she switched to a colorful striped fall sweater for herself. But now the half-finished garment trails off her lap as she watches the house across the street. Her body tenses, and she leans forward slightly. She sees Tom and Karen pull into the driveway and stop, but instead of getting out of the car, they sit there for a moment. Bridget waits expectantly. Now Karen's getting out, and Tom isn't. Bridget wonders where they've been. She thinks a lot about Tom and Karen, about where they are and what they're doing, about their life together. It's like she's caught up in a particularly good television show and can't wait to see what happens next. Bob tells her that she's obsessive. He complains that it's not normal. He tells her she's become obsessed with the Krupps' lives because she's lonely and bored and has nothing to do all day. He tells her she's too smart to be doing nothing. But he doesn't understand. He doesn't know. She watches Tom reverse the car and head back down the street. She can see through the open car window that his face is set and grim. She wonders if they've been arguing. She turns her attention to Karen, now unlocking the front door. She can sense discouragement in the way Karen carries her shoulders. Maybe they have argued. Bridget puts her knitting aside, grabs her keys, and locks her own door behind her. She walks over to Karen's house and rings the bell. When Karen opens the door and sees her, Bridget thinks she looks slightly reserved, even unwelcoming. Why isn't Karen happy to see her? "Hi, Bridget," Karen says, not opening the door wide. "I just got home. I've got a headache. I was actually just going to lie down for a bit before supper."
"Oh," Bridget says, "I thought you looked like you could use a friend."
She gives Karen the warmest smile she knows how.
"Is everything all right?"
"Yes, everything's fine," Karen says. Bridget stands her ground until Karen opens the door wider, and then she steps over the threshold. They settle in the living room. Karen looks exhausted. Her eyes are puffy, as if she's been crying, and her hair has lost its shine. How much she's changed in just a few days, Bridget thinks.
"Why don't you tell me what's going on?" she says. "It might help."
"Nothing's going on," Karen says, running a hand through her lank hair. But Bridget knows she's lying. She's been watching everything unfold from across the street. And Karen looks far too distressed for nothing to be going on. She's not a fool.
She wishes Karen wouldn't take her for one.
Is everything all right between you and Tom?
Bridget asks bluntly.
What? What do you mean?
Karen says, clearly taken aback.
Well, I just saw him drive away, and he looked angry.